The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the House Ag Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good crowd on hand today. We have four bills to go over, and hopefully this will just be a perfunctory thing, but we do have the room reserved again for 6:30 if things go long. Let's hopefully that won't have to happen. But again, four bills on the agenda. Hope to get through all of them in our allotted time, and again, a hard cutoff at 2:45. And because of the weather, the storm we had last night, a couple of our members are with us online today. Representative Lee and Representative Vang are with us. They're here, but they're online on Zoom and can take part in today's meeting as well. So welcome to everybody. Welcome to the Ag Finance and Policy Committee. First bill up, but after we take care of some housekeeping, a quorum is present. And we have to do the minutes of the meeting. Representative Hansen, have you checked the minutes of the last meeting?
Yes, I did, and I would move the minutes from the last meeting.
Very good. Any discussion on that? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Against, same sign. Approved. Minutes have been passed. Thank you. Now on to House File 47, Representative Schultz. I will move your bill to go to the General Register. So, Representative Schultz, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also have an A1 amendment if we'd like to take action on that first, and then we can discuss the underlying bill.
Representative Schultz, to your A1 amendment.
All right, very good, Mr. Chair. Just quickly on the A1 amendment, I am working incredibly well with all of the stakeholders who are engaged in the conversation surrounding broadband installation safety and working together to find what will work for the people of Minnesota. So the A1 amendment is a reflection of that ongoing work to address language that was originally in House File 47 that we are removing from this bill. And so I would encourage support of the A1 amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions or discussion on the A1 amendment? If not, all approved, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same sign. The amendment is approved. Representative, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and great to be before you. And I want to say a quick thank you to everyone who braved the cold and the snow and the roads, I'm sure, which were very challenging to get here today. House File 47 is a bill to address language which was passed a year ago as it relates to the safety standards for broadband installation. I think that there is a common purpose around wanting to ensure that our communities, our homes, our businesses are safe and also have access to fast and reliable and affordable broadband. And so today with House File 47, a bipartisan group of legislators in both bodies of the legislature is working to ensure that we have language that works for the people of Minnesota. So in coordination with the cable folks, with the telecom folks, with contractors across the state, many small businesses, and especially our trade unions, I want to just say a special thank you to everyone who's involved in this conversation, and especially call out LIUNA for their continued work on this too. We are working together to find what can work for the people of Minnesota, which is exactly what you'll see inside this bill. With me are a number of testifiers today to speak to the challenges that we will work through in this, but there's an immense opportunity that we have if we get this right. And there are some challenges on the horizon that we need to address in this session for this year, which this bill gets to. And so I'm actually going to let my first testifier, Melissa, go into the details on that. And so I'll return it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee, and identify yourself and proceed.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Wolf, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, or Minnesota Cable. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 47 today, and I especially want to thank Representative Schultz for bringing this forward and the bipartisan group of House and Senate lawmakers who have signed on to this bill. I also want to acknowledge, as Representative Schultz mentioned, that as an industry, we have had productive stakeholder meetings with everyone that's here today, and we have made a commitment to the authors of this bill to continue those discussions and find compromise. Minnesota is on the verge of achieving universal broadband access, but last year's telecommunications installer law threatens to derail our progress. If not modified to provide flexibility this legislative session, by July 1st of this year, this law will disqualify thousands of experienced broadband installers working anywhere in the seven-county metro area from working on broadband projects until they take 40 hours of state-mandated training and pass an exam. And it will take thousands of experienced broadband workers off the job of deploying broadband in greater Minnesota to take the 40 hours of training and pass an exam. This bill, House File 47, has strong bipartisan support because it makes common sense fixes to what is currently an unworkable law. To be clear, this bill does not call for the repeal of last year's law, nor does it take away any of the safety standards that were established and will be required. However, the following changes to the law are necessary to provide flexibility and ensure the uninterrupted deployment of broadband access across the state. There are three key issues that must be fixed. First, the training timeline is simply impossible. This training program is the first of its kind in the nation. Broadband providers are working in good faith and taking immediate action to develop a compliant program, but the reality is that without a deadline extension, there will not be enough certified trainers to meet demand, and the state will not have enough compliant workers before the July 1st, 2025 deadline. The new law also requires a portion of the training to be hands-on. Underground excavation cannot take place until the ground thaws. Today's weather is a great example that final thaw in Minnesota could be in March, April, or even May in some parts of the state. That leaves us with as little as 2 months to meet a statewide mandate. When this deadline is missed, and under current conditions, it will be, providers and contractors will have three impossible choices. Shut down projects in the middle of peak construction season, continue working out of compliance, putting projects and workers at legal risk, or lose permits delaying broadband access indefinitely for thousands of Minnesotans. In fact, earlier this week, one Minnesota county emailed contractors that work within that county stating that as of July 1st, quote, failure to provide proof of this certification and matching identification to the county will result in immediate work stoppage, eviction of county right-of-way, and permit revocation. None of these are acceptable outcomes for you, for us, or for the people we serve. Second, the training requirements are confusing and contradictory. This inconsistency is a direct result of the lack of clarity in the law and could create a scenario where every broadband worker in the state on any job site would need this certification, something we were told was not intended by proponents of this law. The law also requires at least two certified workers present at all times at any location where broadband is being installed using directional boring. This is a staffing mandate that effectively doubles the required workforce on every job site at a time when qualified workers are already in short supply. Worse, the law doesn't actually define what a job site is. In greater Minnesota, a broadband project can stretch for miles with multiple drill rigs working at once. How many certified workers are required in this case? Nobody has answered this question consistently. Lastly, the 40-hour training requirement is excessive and arbitrary. The law mandates that every broadband worker complete 40 hours of training and pass a new state-mandated test. For context, pipe layers who work on underground water and sewer pipes at far greater depths only need 4 hours of training. The 40-hour requirement will pull thousands of experienced broadband installers off the job for a full week to meet a training requirement not found anywhere else in the country. This bill only makes reasonable adjustments so broadband work is not interrupted and we meet the federal mandate to invest $652 million into Minnesota broadband in the next 4 years. Minnesota can't afford to sidelight its broadband workers. We cannot afford to play games with broadband deployment. We have made great strides in broadband expansion, but now we are at a crossroads. I would ask for your support of House File 47 so that we can keep broadband expansion on track and ensure Minnesota remains a leader in connectivity. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Any questions from members? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for testifying. A couple clarifying questions on some things you said. First, just to bring up a question you said, job sites being defined as a difficulty in this bill, but the bill before us doesn't clarify any of that. All it says is that there's going to be less people that need to be certified on whatever the job site is. So do you feel that this bill addresses that concern that you just mentioned?
I think the bill...
Go ahead, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. What the bill will help us do is make sure that we don't have to double staff on every job site. If you look at the underlying law, anyone that is doing the three jobs that are listed there will still need that certification. This will just make it clear that we don't have to have double the staff when there's directional drilling taking place.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Follow-up question, Representative Smith?
Maybe not on that particular one. Maybe just on the broader question that brings up, I think, is one of the reasons that this law was implemented in the last session was, like, rising damage done to gas lines and things along those lines, which is why these standards are so high, as you're mentioning. And we have, I don't know if there are going to be test fires later, places from, like, cities of Bloomington in the metro and even outside in greater Minnesota, like Austin, that are saying this is incredibly detrimental. And that's why these standards are so high. And why, for example, it's not the same as pipe layers that you mentioned specifically. So, I mean, how would you answer folks to say, like, the reason these are so high is because there has been damage to our pipes, and we want to make sure that's done safely. Why minimize these things that will solve that problem before they're even implemented?
Ms. Wolf?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, obviously, safety is paramount for our industry. Everybody that's in this room today takes, you know, safety as their top priority. They all want to go home to their families at night. We want them to, and they don't want, you know, they live and work in the communities that they're working in, and they don't want to cause damage. I won't tell you that there isn't damage that's taking place out there. Certainly there, you know, this does happen. Last session, Representative Kraft carried a bill that actually made changes to our underground excavation law that I think will be the answer to a lot of these safety concerns and issues that we're seeing in the field. It allows more time for locates. It makes it more clear on the type of markings you have to have. It requires pre-construction meetings. Those are the types of things that will actually improve safety in the field. And I think what we've heard from contractors is that this bill really doesn't do much to address a lot of those safety issues, especially around locates. And again, I want to just reiterate that the bill isn't taking away any of the safety training that will be needed through this program. We just don't need 40 hours to complete it.
Representative Smith, Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, kind of just to follow up on that line, so is the main concern about the standards that were put in place is that the hours of training are too long, or the whole set of safety requirements in general?
Ms. Wolf, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I had a hard time hearing what you asked.
Yeah, I'm just saying, is the main concern about the 40 hours and that is the main issue, or is there actually concern about all of the safety requirements that are put in place for the betterment of workers and the residents?
Ms. Wolf?
Mr. Chair, so as I testified, I think the three issues here is that we weren't given enough time. We need more time to get the thousands of workers that are going to need this certification to get through this program and be compliant so that they can continue working. I think the other issue is we need more clarity around the staffing mandate in the field. And the last piece is that it is a very onerous training for people that have been doing this work for decades in the field. And so I think those are the three issues. It's, you know, we're not changing anything in the law that says, you know, these are the things that have to be trained on. All we're saying is we need more time, flexibility, and clarity to complete it and get these people compliant and certified.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The goal of this bill is to make this workable for us. So it doesn't take away safety standards. This just ensures that we have the timelines to make it effective for us all so that communities are safe, workers are safe, and at the same time, we're also not limiting the investments that are going to be made, honestly, in your community. And that's the goal, is just for it all to work together. That's my goal with this bill, and I'll continue to work towards that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Agbaje.
Yeah, I guess... I mean, this probably isn't really a full question, but I mean, one thing to think about is what you're removing from this bill is sort of, you know, having those two safety qualified installers and then also pushing back the time frame, right? Like it's a staggered bill, so like the first set of folks would be available for the metro area. That was done over a year ago, probably. And so I guess I'm a little bit concerned that what had been done in that time from when the bill passed to July of 2025 to prepare for that, for at least the seven county metro area, and why now all of this is an emergency all of a sudden. And then also, what is it about having two people at the site that makes it completely onerous? So, I mean, you can respond to that if you want. I'm sure we'll hear more from the testifiers, but I'm just a little bit lost as to why those are the main concerns. Thank you.
Want to respond, Ms. Wolf?
Sure. Maybe I'll just address. I tried to hit on this in my testimony, and Mr. Chair, Representative. So this law is the first of its kind in the nation. It does not exist anywhere else. That means we also don't have a pool of qualified trainers to take from to come and actually train these folks. So first, when this law passed last session, we had to let everybody know in the field that they have to now be compliant with this program. And I will tell you that there are a lot of associations and contractors that are just finding out now that they need this, that they need to do this. This is a group of folks that have never had to be in front of the Department of Labor and Industry before. Also, these programs didn't exist. So every program that the department is approving right now had to be created in the last year, then get approval by DLI. Then we have to train trainers to train the workers that are going to get the certification. And that's what's happening right now. And then within that time as well, as I mentioned in my testimony, part of this is hands-on that we can't actually start doing until the weather is better. And that's the problem with the July 1st deadline.
Follow-up, Representative? Okay, thank you. Representative Smith. Oh, okay, sorry. Representative Lawrence had a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I think in my understanding, the bigger question to this request of this bill and this being brought forth is that we have a timeline that if these projects are not done, broadband in greater Minnesota, that is, the grants are there, the money is there to do it. If it's not done completed in a timely manner, those dollars are lost. Could we have a representative or a testifier comment on that?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lawrence. Our goal is to make this workable. Currently, with the way that the bill is outlined on the dates provided and then especially the amount of hours together, those two things make it challenging to get the totality of the number of workers that work in this space through those training modules that are just being set up, right? There are some who have a couple that have already been set up already. There's different associations who are working through that process with DLI in a very cooperative manner to try and make that happen. It's just we're stretched for time on this, and it should happen in a normal and natural cycle. So consider contractors, consider workers, consider union members who, honest to goodness, they're out doing the work as soon as they have the chance to do it when there's the thaw. And we need to provide for the opportunity for them to do it in a way that's flexible so that, one, everybody's safe. Number two, that we're able to do this in a way that's not impacting the rollout of broadband installation.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, there have been a number of assertions on safety. I was looking at the list of testifiers, and maybe, Mr. Chair, if there's someone from CenterPoint or the gas companies that could be here to discuss at the end of all the other testifiers. It'd be good to hear on the safety side from those folks.
Thank you, Representative. And yes, there is somebody from CenterPoint here who would be available, and we'll call them up after we've gone through the list of published testifiers here. Ms. Wolf, thank you. Stay around if there are more questions. And next up, we have Nick Anderson and then Brent Christensen on deck. Mr. Anderson, identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As was said, my name is Nick Anderson. I'm here representing Anderson Underground, a company out of Sauk Rapids.
And also into the mic, okay?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. Also, my broader organization, Selenerk Holdings, are collectively, we employ about 500 people and have been serving the telecommunications industry for over 45 years. And we do projects all over the country, as well as the seven county metro area and outstate Minnesota. So we are directly affected by these current and proposed training requirements. We feel that the intent of the legislation is good, and we agree that damage prevention focus is very important, but we strongly believe there's some problems with the implementation to what we're trying to do here. So we, like many other companies in the room, are active members of the Power and Communication Contractors Association. I myself am a board member. The PCCA has helped its members establish a Department of Labor recognized underground utility installer technician apprenticeship program, of which our company is currently enrolled. This apprenticeship program requires participants to complete a classroom component as well as competency-based field-demonstrated skill sets. Our program is recognized by the Department of Labor at the federal level.
Take your time.
Yeah, we're recognized at the federal level. We think we should also be recognized at the state level as a qualifier for the certification. Without some allowances for current proven qualified workers to do their jobs, we're at risk of delaying projects and pushing an already depleted workforce out of our state. Additionally, our company CEO, Steve Selenrick, is a Common Ground Alliance board member. We use CGA best practices in our daily operations. Their approach involves all stakeholders in the damage prevention process and not just the contractors. Through industry initiatives, CGA has set a goal of 50% reduction in utility damages over the next 5 years. Our company has internally documented a 90% decrease in at-fault utility hits and a 60% overall decrease on gateway fiber projects, specifically using CGA's best practices. If damage prevention is a true driver of the legislation at hand, all stakeholders, contractors, utility owners, locating companies, and municipalities need to be part of the solution together and should strongly consider joining the CGA, participating in their Damage Prevention Institute, and adopting their best practices.
Could you wrap up your testimony?
Yes, sir.
In a few seconds? Thank you.
Yes, sir. We feel immediate changes need to be made to the current law to keep projects on track. Our request is to recognize Federal Department of Labor Registered Apprenticeship Programs as a means of contractor qualifications. Also, we'd like to see all stakeholders join the CGA and participate in their Damage Prevention Institute. Without the recommended changes, we risk contractors leaving the state over redundant training. Furthermore, by looking at only one stakeholder, the contractor, we're failing to solve a more complex damage prevention problem in our communities.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Questions for the testifier? If not, Mr. Christensen, go ahead. And thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. We are a mixture of cooperatives, family-owned companies, privately held and publicly traded companies throughout the state of Minnesota. And even though we have different corporate structures, we have one thing in common, and that's our commitment to serving Minnesota. Last year alone, MTA members invested nearly $300 million in private capital to expand broadband in Minnesota. And I'm here today in support of House File 47. Mr. Chairman, let me start out my testimony by telling you what this bill is not. This bill is not anti-union. We have several MTA members that are union shops and employ over 750 union members. This bill is not a repeal of a hastily passed legislation from last year. It merely addresses a few of the issues that are necessary to make our industry get into compliance. Let's also be clear that the law passed last year is not about safety. It's about creating a new education program. If it were strictly about safety, then it would be housed in the Office of Pipeline Safety and not Department of Labor and Industry. If this were about safety, then it would apply more than just the telecommunications industry, and it would apply to all utilities. If it were about safety, then it would apply to more than just locators and laborers. If this were about safety, it would use the tools that are already in statute. Last year, the authority of the Office of Pipeline Safety was beefed up to address utility damage. In addition, nothing in our industry goes into the ground without local government permits. Those permitting authorities have the ability to require safe practices or pull the permit. That is where the efforts for a more safe underground installation should be focused. Now, all that said, MTA has gone through the process of our Underground Telecommunications Installer Certification Program, or UTIC, and it has been approved by the Department of Labor and Industry. MTA has a specific telecom safety education program that's been around since 1981. We provide training to over 3,000 employees in over 60 companies in 8 states. And even with all of that experience and knowledge, our staff struggled to come up with 40 hours of relevant content. This makes sense if you consider the UTIC program was patterned after the pipe layers certification, which is only 4 hours. Our goal for over 10 years has been to work with the state on true border-to-border broadband. This issue just doesn't affect Minnesotans in Carlstead or Byron or Pipestone, but also Minnesotans in Minneapolis, Burnsville, and Savage.
Could you wrap up your testimony quickly?
Members, I strongly urge you to support this bill. Let's fix this and get back to the work of deploying quality broadband to all Minnesotans. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Questions from members? Representative Smith, next to Michelle Benson, you're on deck, okay? So, Ms. Representative Smith, go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you for your testimony. Maybe just ask a specific question, because we've heard the difficulties in training folks from multiple testifiers already. What are you currently planning now as we're, you know, this is coming up pretty soon? How many classes are scheduled? How many people are enrolled in those classes? Because we heard that right now it's impossible for this to be done. I'm just curious, like, can you help me out with the logistics of why that would be impossible?
Mr. Christensen.
Chairman, Representative Smith, that's a very good question. We didn't get the guidance from Dolly until last November on what's going to need to be in the classes. So we worked hard with that, and we were the second program that was approved in December. We are currently working on the content, actually the delivery of that, and forming the classes, doing the presentations, and doing all of that. We hope to have that rolled out by the middle of March. We are going to do the classroom portion of the 40 hours. We're going to do the classroom portion of that and start classes as soon as we can. We're doing it through a delivery of online different methods. We have an online component, we have a virtual component, and an in-person training. And we will be signing up our members of our safety program. We've had a lot of interest outside of our program for people to get that training. We don't know if we have the capacity yet to do that, so we're focused on our members first. And then we'll see about expanding it.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Next up, Michelle Benson. Go ahead, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank
and
you.
Joel Hansen's on deck, by the way. Sorry.
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, and committee members. My name is Michelle Benson. I am Director of Energy and Commerce Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on House File 47. The Chamber and our more than 6,300 members know that digital commerce drives a vibrant, local, and competitive economy. More than 5,000 of our members have fewer than 100 employees. They're located in districts all across the state of Minnesota, including your districts. Minnesota businesses require robust, modern, secure, and accessible communications, data and information infrastructure, systems, and networks. And if you're like me and you have a kid home e-learning today, all the e-learning kids need that too. Direct investments as well as regulatory frameworks in the digital ecosystem itself impact Minnesota businesses as suppliers and purchasers of goods and services. Minnesota's telecommunications providers have invested billions of dollars to build out infrastructure, increasing access, speed, and availability for customers. In addition, public investment in broadband expansion has reached hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years, with significant funding already guaranteed over the next decade. This legislation amends last year's Underground Telecommunications Installer Certification Program, a training and safety initiative for broadband contractors that did add significant barriers to broadband deployment. The sensible adjustments in this bill will keep safety education in place while reducing barriers to timely, efficient broadband deployment across Minnesota to ensure that available federal funding is utilized in service to Minnesotans. We thank Representative Schultz, the co-authors, and all the advocates giving advice on this legislation to make sure that Minnesota can move at the speed of information. Thank you, Representative Schultz, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to Joel Hansen, and then Kevin Prannis is on deck.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 47. My name is Joel Hansen. I'm the Director of Government Affairs with Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. ABC is a construction industry trade organization with over 350 local members that promote fair and open competition in the construction industry. Our members employ over 20,000 men and women who are part of the 3 out of 4 in the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. So following passage of this legislation last session, ABC has worked to develop a DALI-approved, safety-qualified underground telecommunications installer certification program. It's a mouthful, so we call it SQUIDDY. But our SQUIDDY program is going to be operational by early spring. And per the current requirements of the legislation, it's going to require individuals seeking to become SQUIDDY certified to complete 40 hours of training, which includes both classroom and hands-on instruction, and pass an exam certifying their proficiency. Importantly, our program is open to all, regardless of employer, trade organization, or labor affiliation. So as far as we know, we're the only truly open SQUIDDY program. So as such, we expect to take on a large share of the folks that are seeking this training, perhaps the majority. And so our current estimates are around 1,000, but every week we're getting calls from more and more that are seeking training. And so taking into account Minnesota's abbreviated construction season, we just do not think it's possible to get every employee that needs a certification prior to the July 1st, 2025 deadline. That's why we are very much in support of extending this out to January 1st of 2026. And so with that, I will stand for questions.
Thanks, Mr. Hansen. Questions from any member of the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question about SQUIDDY. I didn't know that was the name of it. So you said it is currently designed and approved at 40 hours.
So
Mr. Hansen, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my apologies, and Representative Smith, thanks for that question. So, yes, so obviously that's the current law, and so as such, everyone that is submitting proposals to DALI is going to have to meet those requirements, and the current requirements are 40 hours.
Representative Smith.
So if this bill were to pass in its current form, you're taking out 30 hours of a course you've already prepared. 30 hours, what are you taking out?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. So again, it's if you look at the actual legislation, so there's requirements that need to be met within the education. So think of it as a course syllabus. You need to have proficiency in these particular areas. Again, the requirement on the hours is a little bit subjective in the sense that if the state says it's 40 hours, then we're going to meet that. But ultimately, you need to be proficient in those particular skills, and not necessarily it has to be a 40-hour program. And I think that kind of mirrors the testimony that Mr. Christensen had as well.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Yeah. Kevin, are you here? There we go. If I missed your name pronunciation, I apologize. Go ahead and identify yourself, and let's hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and committee members, and Representative Schultz. Kevin Pranis, on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, in North Dakota, we represent 14,000 construction laborers who do a wide variety of construction, buildings, civil infrastructure, energy, and telecommunications infrastructure. And appreciate the chance to speak to this bill. First, just want to clarify a couple of things about the process for the passage of the broadband safety bill. It was crafted based on a year's worth of research, interviews with broadband workers and contractors, energy utilities, state and local officials. What we found was high rates of damage that were driven by high turnover rates, which Ms. Representative Schultz and contractors have cited as a challenge in this industry, together with a lack of consistent training. The existing regulatory requirements were simply not working to prevent repeat and serious damage and protect our communities. I do take exception to Mr. Christensen's statement that this was not about safety. So not only was this bill about safety and entirely motivated by safety and focused on the unsafe practices that had been identified by experts in the field, but we have heard since the bill was enacted from cities, from utilities and other stakeholders that it is an important safety bill that they believe will help keep us all safer. Second, I want to talk an overview of what we know a year after the original effort to pass the bill. First, many Minnesota communities are facing a crisis when it comes to substandard and unsafe broadband installation, a problem more severe than it appeared last year and getting worse. The data, the CenterPoint and the North Star Policy Action can speak to. I'll speak to the stories that we've heard from cities, counties, utilities, and workers. Everything from seeing workers wearing Crocs and socks and sandals doing installation. You see that in the Austin letter. We've seen it ourselves. Workers who describe seeing coworkers electrocuted when they hit buried electric lines. Cities that describe nightmare experiences like Bloomington and Austin, and those are just the tip of the iceberg, including frequent damage to gas lines. I would also say Department of Labor and Industry has done an extraordinary job rolling out this program at record speed with 7 programs already approved. That's probably faster than any of the new legislation of the last 2 years to get done with the help of DEED, Gopher State One, Collin Office of Pipeline Safety for education. And it's already helping limit the market presence of bad out-of-state actors, which we've heard from one of Mr. Christensen's members in the Workforce Committee. We have specific concerns on HF47, and there are these. First, delaying implementation until January 1st means that 3 million Minnesotans will continue to face service interruptions and safety hazards caused by out-of-state contractors. No Minnesotan should worry about their family's safety because an out-of-state contractor cut corners, damaged a gas line, tried to patch it with duct tape, and buried it again, hoping no one would notice, which actually happened in Bloomington, as their letter details. Second, cutting training requirements from 40 to 10 hours undermines efforts to ensure that workers in safety-critical roles know what they're doing. That, in fact, would turn safety standards into a box-checking exercise. And with respect to Representative Schultz, cutting training from 40 to 10 hours does take away safety standards. I would point out vis-a-vis pipe layers, our union trains the majority of pipe layers in the state, and they have to take 80 hours of training before they're allowed to take an exam through our program. And finally, clarification on which workers must be certified. We agree that that's worth doing and are waiting for the Minnesota Telecom Alliance to pull together contractors so we can workshop and make sure we have the same idea of who has to be covered. I would finally say...
Can you wind up your testimony? Quick.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
Yes, sir. In terms of BEAD, the law has no impact. That's why the Office of Broadband Development was comfortable with the law, and this law will do nothing to enhance the ability to roll out DEED. And finally, I would point out that contractors are already filing for dig tickets, which means that they believe they will be able to dig in coming weeks. If we can dig for construction, we can dig for training, and so we'd like to see the industry step up on that side. Thank you very much, and I'm available for questions.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Prentice. Last testifier is Jake Schweter. Welcome. Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jake Schweitzer, and I am the Executive Director for North Star Policy Action. We are an independent research and communications institute dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. I'm here today to ground this conversation with a sense of the scale of the problem that we're facing. Last year, we conducted an analysis of the problem done to underground infrastructure in Minnesota in the years 2020 to 2022. And all of our data came directly from the Common Ground Alliance, the industry working group focused on preventing damage to underground infrastructure. We didn't make this data up. What we found was alarming. Telecommunications installation was the leading cause of damage to buried infrastructure in Minnesota by a substantial margin, averaging more than one strike per day. This telecom-induced damage was not only more common, but also generally done to essential utilities, including nearly half of all telecom hits occurring to natural gas lines, such as the one that caused the 1998 explosion in St. Cloud that killed 4 people. The scale of telecom damage looks even more troubling when focusing on specific types of work that were shared across utilities. 60% of all damage taking place in Minnesota during directional drilling came from telecom installation. While telecom, electric, and gas utilities all engage in directional drilling, telecom accounted for twice as many damage incidents as electric and gas utilities combined. Telecom's drilling damage is also distinct in terms of the source of error, where more than 3/4 of drilling hits from natural gas and electric are attributed to locator error. Nearly half of all telecom damage came from excavator errors, indicating mistakes made by the people doing the drilling. And where our report focused on 2020 to 2022, we are currently updating our analysis to include newly available data for 2023. And unfortunately, far from indicating a declining issue, it would appear that things got worse for telecom installation in 2023. Our analysis, which we will be publishing soon, suggests that telecom has made up a growing share of underground damage year over year, including an increasing number of strikes to natural gas lines, and particularly large jumps in damage from directional drilling and excavator error. Last year, the legislature took a big step forward in addressing what we found to be a serious public and worker safety problem in passing the broadband safety bill. The data show that telecom installation remains a significant and growing source of damage, and we have serious concerns about any efforts to undo that progress.
Can you wipe up or wrap up your...
I'm all finished. Thank you so much, and I look forward to any questions.
Questions from members. Is Mr. Schweitzer wrapped up his testimony? Sorry about that.
No, I'll get
Thank
it.
You very much. Sure. Anybody in Representative Hansen, you had mentioned something about boring, and I think there's somebody from the gas company here who could come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So when they get there, go ahead and ask your question. Welcome, ma'am. Could you identify yourself for the record first?
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Crystal Gores. I'm the Damage Prevention Manager at CenterPoint Energy. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak.
We had a question first.
Representative
Hansen, go ahead.
Sure. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at your experience with CenterPoint and what you could tell us in the field on safety.
Go ahead, ma'am.
I'm glad you asked. The magnitude of fiber that is being installed is causing a dramatic increase in damages to our facilities. In reviewing the last 2 years of data, the top two telecom damage issues causers are inadequate hand digging, which means they failed to expose the utility without damage, usually digging with a shovel right over top the locate marks, causing damage. The second one is failure to hand dig within tolerance zone. What that means is they failed to pothole and spot the utility before they cross it, and they didn't monitor the depth of the directional drill head, and that caused damage. We call that blind boring, so they're not taking the precautions. We feel that having the safety certified installers, which is outlined in this law, would absolutely help those top two causes for damages. Interestingly,
Go ahead, ma'am.
In 2023, our total damages, underground damages, were 783. Of those damages, 27%, so 213, were due to telecommunication damages. In 2024, we took a really big jump. Our total damages were 870, an 11% increase from the previous year. And of those, 342 were telecommunication damages. That's 39%. That's a 60% increase. It's concerning for us. We feel that education best practices and the dig law would be also beneficial to be included in the safety certification training. We have local contractors that don't comply and out-of-state contractors that don't know the best practices or the law, so that's an issue.
Representative Hansen, any further questions? Did you have it? Wrap it up, ma'am?
Yes, that's all I have. No questions.
Thank Representative Lee, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. So I'm just curious, you know, of the 342 damages, can you let us know what's the cost to CenterPoint or to the ratepayers of the state of Minnesota because of the disturbance and the service?
That is an excellent question, and I apologize. I was worried about boring everybody with details, even though they're important. It's considerable. If you have a service line that's damaged, we can range anywhere from 500 to 1,000. Part of the problem when you have a directional drill damage, sometimes there's damage that occurs and they don't know they hit it. If it's not spotted like it's supposed to, when the operator comes out because of the emergency, they actually have to take the time to find where that leak is. And that takes considerable time. So if they damage, say, a service line and they continue working, they're crossing multiple other facilities. So we don't know what they hit. So there's an increased risk with that, but also increased cost because it's going to take us more time to determine where the damage is.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So can you tell us, you know, when there's a damage, who's responsible for that? Is it CenterPoint you have to pay for, you know, to fix that, or is that, you know, push on to our rate payers, or, you know, is the contractor that did the damage, are they responsible for that?
Excellent question. So
go ahead, ma'am.
We investigate, Chair and committee, sorry, I'm new at this. We investigate the damages as they come in, and we bill the contractor who's responsible, and that would be whether if it's the contractor that caused the damage or if it's, say, our locator that mismarked the facility, we would bill them in turn as well. So whoever's responsible for the damage. If it is us that's responsible, of course it isn't billed, it's CenterPoint Energy's responsibility. And all this information is reported out for who's responsible for what and the root cause for all of our damages to MinOps.
Thank you very much. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair Committee.
See, nobody else in the audience who would care to test? Oh, we have one testifier. Come on up, sir.
And Mr. Chair, we'd like a roll call on the bill.
Roll call has been requested. It will be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, sir. Your name and go ahead.
My name is Jason Clare. I represent STF Services. We're one of the small companies that actually does this work every day. And I'm really glad that Crystal just was up here because yesterday I came up here to give you a real-world example of how this work happens, how these damages happen. And yesterday we had a great example of this. We had one street that I have two crews working on because we're the ones who like to get punished by working in the winter. So, but there's one street there, on that one street with two cul-de-sacs. Out of the 15 gas services we need marked, 14 of them were mismarked, which means way off their mark. I'm talking 20-plus feet, most of them. Okay, this is a problem because I didn't only have that. I also had a mismarked power line, a primary that would feed power to the entire cul-de-sac. 16 houses would have been without power also. Okay, I had a valid locate ticket. We called it in. We followed the laws. Everything said it was marked and cleared. There was paint on the ground. And by the law that already exists, we followed it to the T. We could have, as a company, just cleared out a window and at the depth that we're going to bore through, and we could have bored through those areas because we cleared out the tolerance that they have to locate. And I guarantee you we would have caused damage to multiple homes or multiple gas services and probably taken out the primary power to the whole neighborhood, right? I'm telling you this because this is the vast majority. I've been doing this for 14 years. I'm still out in the field every day with my guys doing stuff. And over the 14-year period, this is the vast majority of the causes of these damages that we're talking about. And this was an extreme example because it was all on one street and there was 14 of them. It's not usually that bad on one little section, but this was an extreme case, which actually was CenterPoint Gas. I worked most of the day with CenterPoint damage prevention people to correct it, right? We could have just kept boring, done the legal things that we had to do, worried about our bottom line, but instead we shut down production. And we worked with the CenterPoint crew. We called Vanguard out there for the power, worked with them, and we got everything squared away. And it cost us thousands of dollars in lost production and downtime. We don't get to bill anybody for that. But if we wanted to be greedy and just go for it, we could have got our production in, and there would have been people down on their service. There would be more damages to report. It's not our fault that this happens, right? But we take it upon ourselves. We go above and beyond what the law requires already because we do care about the safety of our employees, of the homes that we're servicing. We don't want people to be without power, right, especially wintertime. Or like Crystal said, sometimes you don't know if there's a gas that it can leak into the house, cause other problems, right?
Can you wrap up your testimony, sir?
I can.
Thank you.
This law doesn't do anything to address. It's the largest cause of damages that we run into in all the time that I've been doing this. I've been doing this for well over a decade, and this law wants me to go pay $800 for a class that doesn't exist yet. I can't sign up for one. I've tried. I've called everybody that has classes. I can't even sign up for one. They want me to take a week of my life, stop working, go do this training, and what are they going to teach me other than what the law already is? It's already in the law what we're supposed to do. If we just enforce the laws, like the utility companies are by law required to have their utilities located in a timely fashion, what the law states, and within a tolerance, which is stated in the law. If that was enforced, and that could actually have some teeth to it, I guarantee you the damages would go way down in all types of drilling and digging.
Thank you, sir.
Testimony. Thank you.
Any further questions from members? Representative Gander.
For you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. We're talking about...
And speak up to the mic, Representative.
Oh, yeah. Yep. We're talking about what looks like possibly exponential growth in damaging of gas lines and other underground utilities with this boring that we're doing for telecom. But could you also quantify for me the total amount of telecom boring that took place 2022, 2023, 2024? Are we doing more boring in each of those successive years? To say, you know what, maybe we don't have an exponential problem. Maybe we're just doing a lot more boring each successive year.
Representative Schultz, or do you want to phone a friend?
No, this is a relatively easy one for you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gander. Look, we are on the precipice of having the opportunity to have $652 million of BEAD dollars from the federal level implemented to serve our constituents across this state. So we are going to continue to see an increase in this. And so to this point, to this conversation, clearly there's a lot of voices that are important to have at this table to ensure that we have safety in our communities as this installation is happening. And so that's what we're committed to working on this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative?
Yeah. So my question then really is, are we seeing more damage per foot of boring? Are we just seeing more boring going on, right? It's not as though suddenly these contractors got sloppy. It could be that we're just doing a lot more work, and because of that, just mathematically, that's how it's going to happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz, comment?
There's not much more to add to that, except for that I think that this is might be grounds for another piece of legislation to work on the locating.
Okay. Seeing no Representative Smith didn't see you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Schultz. One clarifying question, and it's based on I have a couple questions. The first one I'm going to ask about what Representative Lawrence asked earlier about Greater Minnesota. I just want to clarify the timeline in this bill only is extended to the 7-county metro area, correct? It's not changing any of those Greater Minnesota programs. That's going to continue to stay January 1st. I just want to confirm that that is the case.
Representative Smith or Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Smith. Yes, so for everybody's frame of reference, so that we're all on the same page here, these standards are, and the training for each of these workers needs to be done, if they're working in the metro area, by July 1st of this year, which we're seeking to change in this bill to push it to January 1st of next year, which is when all other installers need to be meeting this standard. And so we're just marrying up the two and making this workable for everyone.
Representative Smith?
Yep. Sorry about the Schultz-Smith back and forth. I know that is very close. Thank you for that clarification. Kind of generally a question I asked here. I mean, from the testimony, it seems clear why I think the industry would want this sort of bill. It is less onerous on them. It is quicker to get this certification. But from like a public health perspective, we've heard from our utilities. We have testifiers from cities, and I can tell you my local utility, which is the largest municipal utility in the state, is also concerned about this. I don't understand from our perspective where, when we have a problem that is rising in concern, why are we stripping back these safety measures? This is an open question. I mean, this seems like this is just something this particular industry would like to be less onerous upon themselves, while at the same time we have a public desire to not have gas leaks, which I think we'd all agree on. So at a basic level, I don't understand the need for this legislation at this time.
Comment, follow-up?
Question mark.
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. The goal here is really that we're not having a situation where this summer that installation stops in the metro area or that it's significantly hindered. Right? That's the goal. I completely agree with you with the goal for safety, to get these installations made, to ensure that we're not having more hits. And at the same time, we just need to help make this work together. At the same time, like if it was you or I, and we were one of the broadband installers, one of the workers, we want to be out making money and benefiting our families, because we need to when the sun shines, okay? And the goal here with this legislation is to make it more naturally formed to the time of the year when they're not able to do this work. There's a very small group of contractors and others who are able to do this in the middle of winter by comparison to the prime time, which would be over the course of the summer. I am appreciative and grateful for the work that has been done by those in industry, by those in trade unions, and by our Department of Labor and Industry to get this set up as quickly as possible, realizing I just think the timeline is too tight to ensure all those things that we agree upon.
We had one more.
I can ask a follow-up.
Okay.
Sorry.
One more follow-up.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing that. I mean, my response to that would be, I think also those families would want to make sure like gas leaks aren't happening in their community or loss of power, which has been a problem. My follow-up question is to follow up on something you said in the workforce testimony that you gave earlier, specifically around the workforce that is involved in this industry being transient. And we heard another testifier talk about out-of-state workers coming in. Isn't this the diminishing of the training certifications going to make that problem worse and not better?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, the quick answer to you is no. Our goal here with this piece of legislation, and ultimately I believe the statute that's currently in place, and where you heard some common ground between industry and trade unions in this conversation, is that we need to identify who on a site, let's just say you have five people, who on a site needs to be trained. That's the open question that everybody in the conversation is seeking clarity to, which is what I'm committed to working through during this session.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. I guess kind of following along the same lines of Representative Smith, if the issue really is just the timing of when the training is happening, why isn't this just a bill to push back the start date? Why is it that we are cutting out some of the safety requirements that, you know, cities have told us that they need, the utilities have told us that they need? Why go the extra step to actually take off those regulations?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, could I ask you a clarifying question as to which safety standard you feel is being removed in this underlying statute?
Representative Agbaje.
Sure. I mean, you take out lines 1.17 through 1.19, which is the two safety qualified underground telecommunications installers, which I think people have talked about. It would be nice to know. And I think you even sort of alluded to that about, like, who there on the site needs to have that training to know where they need to dig, right? So instead of clarifying that, you just remove that standard, right? And then also on the training, the amount of training required, it, you know, drops it down by 75%. And so I think that's where I'm seeing a lot of the concerns coming from. I mean, even the city of Bloomington says that even if something like this should go through, they want a minimum hours of 24 hours, not 10. 10 is too small for them. So my thing is, like, and then through a lot of the testimony, what I've heard over and over, the theme I'm hearing is we haven't had enough time to set up the trainings. The trainings that are being set up are meeting the 40 hours. So why isn't this just a bill to say, you know what, maybe July 1, 2025 is too soon. Let's put everybody at July 1 or January 1, 2026. Why not just stop there?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, you and I are very close to the exact same page here. So that's what the first section regards to pushing it to January 1st, 2026. The second point that is important, so lines 1.17 and 1.18 and 9, that section is specifically the point where all of the folks who have testified here today have said, let's sort out exactly what this means. So is this the final language that you're going to see passed and signed into law at the end of the day of this session? No, it's not. There is additional work that needs to be done on this. That language is what's used for now to say that we don't necessarily need two of the same person being in that position having been trained. That's all that that's saying.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Schultz, for that clarification. But again, you've taken out all of those people. So I don't understand where, like, when that new language would come in. If you don't have it yet, is that being worked on?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. This, the underlying statute, and I'm not sure if you have that in front of you now or not. All that removing lines 1.7 through 1.9 does is just remove the requirement for two. So you still have these other positions in the underlying statute that still have to have the safety standard and the training. So it's removing the redundancy in this circumstance.
Representative Agbaje?
No, nothing further, Mr. Chair. I guess my last comment would really just be, you know, it does seem like there's still a lot of questions. So I, you know, would be very much interested in seeing kind of where those discussions end up, because I think right now we're sort of leaving the situation still in the same place it was when the law was passed last year, and I'm not necessarily sure we're getting closer to a point. And so would just be interested in seeing those conversations and seeing where they end up.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, you've just indicated there was more work to be done. The place for that to be done is in this committee rather than passing it out. Sending it out and getting it on the general register And having, quote, people work on it really means, implies that that work would be done in the dark of night. It would not be done in the daylight. This committee would be the daylight where that should occur. So I'm going to recommend a no vote on this because you've said yourself there's work to be done. And we want to make sure we're doing that with the people of Minnesota, not just the vested interest.
Final comments before we go to a vote, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you once again to each of the testifiers who came to testify and share your perspectives on this bill today and for the great engagement on this issue. And I look forward to continuing this work. And to your point, Representative Hansen, because of the dynamics of this House of Representatives, I know for a fact that this work is going to be done in a way that ensures that the public has their voices heard and that they can see the conversations that are going on. So I'm confident in that, and that's why I encourage support and to see this through to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 47 be passed and sent on to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll. And the chair votes aye.
Representative Harder?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Smith?
In its current form, no.
Representative Agbaje?
No.
Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
No.
Representative Gander?
Aye.
Representative Jacob?
Jacob, yes.
Representative Lawrence?
Lawrence votes yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Fang?
No.
There were 7 ayes and 6 nays. The motion passes, and the bill will be sent on to the General Register. Next bill up, and I think I should again remind members that it looks like we may be coming back tonight. We'll reconvene at 6:30 back here if we don't finish by hard 2:45.
That's what they're here for.
All right, our next item of business is House File 434. Chair Anderson will present the bill on behalf of Representative Franson. Chair Anderson, would you like to move House File 434?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 434 to be laid over here in the Ag Committee.
Chair Anderson moves that House File 434 be to be laid over. Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, we heard about this last year as well. It would allow facilities in the state here of Minnesota to import some, in this case, reindeer from the state of Washington. And we've heard about, you know, AZA and ZAA, those are two different types of zoo accreditation. And what this bill would do would be to allow the transfer of these animals, interstate transfer, between a AZA member and one who is licensed by the USDA, licensed exhibitor of regulated animals, and who also houses other AZA certified animals as well. There's a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair. I'd like to hear those now if we could.
I have on the list Joan Hemker, Hemker Park and Zoo. And that is being done remotely. Please introduce yourself and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Hi, I am Joan Hemker, chair and committee members. I am Joan Hemker, the founder and co-owner of Hemker Park and Zoo, and I am here today to support in support of the Minnesota House File 434, an amendment to the Farm Survey Minnesota 35.155. At Hemker Park and Zoo, our mission is to promote animal species and advocate for the environmental conservation through partnerships and wildlife management. We have cared for reindeer for over 35 years and seek an exception to continue safeguarding these animals through genetic diversity and community education. As one of the only three zoological facilities in Minnesota with reindeer, it is crucial for us to maintain our herd and bring in new reindeer from an accredited zoos for responsible population management. Reindeer are exceptional creatures, not just because they are Santa's preferred animals, but also due to their remarkable characteristics that help them thrive in their environment. Some of these traits are reindeers have a unique two-coat layer to insulate them from the harsh winters. Unlike most deer species, reindeer calves are born without spots. Both females and males have antlers. Hemker Park and Zoo houses over 48 animals from 26 different AZA institutions right here in Minnesota. For every animal we house at our facility for an AZA institution, we go through an extremely rigorous inspection, with them on site inspecting our husbandry policies, the exhibits, daily care, vet care programs, animal standards, with the emphasis that focuses on staff, animal, and public safety. We have met and exceeded over 26 AZA institution inspections. In addition, one of the co-owners of Hemker Park and Zoo is a member of AZA. We also are involved in numerous breeding programs to maximize genetic diversity, ensuring the preservation of these animals for future generations. Affording AZA accreditation institutions and not a USDA licensed exhibitor of regulated animals that houses animals owned by institutions accredited by the American Zoo and Aquarium Association and participates in American Zoo and Aquarium Association Species Survival Program is truly unjust. While excluding the above entities, we follow those requirements. It is also problematic from a legal perspective. The Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution requires state government bodies to treat an individual in the same manner as others in similar conditions and circumstances. Singling out USDA licensed zoos that house animals owned by AZA facilities and work with the species survival programs for more restrictive treatment could violate the zoo's right to equal protection under the law and from an animal welfare and public safety perspective, has no rational basis. As the current exemption allows zoological facilities to import cervidae into the state, as a woman-owned business based in Minnesota, our goal is to advocate for equality, similar to the acknowledgement an AZA entity would receive. Our plea is not to bring in white-tailed deer into Minnesota, but to continue our work with reindeer and genetic diversity. Hemker Park and Zoo fully supports and urges the Amendment H-434 to Minnesota Statute 35.155. Thank you for listening to me, and I am available for any questions.
Are there any questions for members for the testifier? All right, seeing none. Chair Anderson, do you have any other testifiers?
Yes, there's a representative here from the DNR.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Pat Rivers. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Just about a year ago at this time, the Washington State Department of Fisheries and Wildlife discovered a deer that had died just north of Spokane, Washington. That deer tested positive for CWD. The ensuing fall required hunters in eastern Washington, Region 1, to come bring their deer in for sampling. That sampling of over 1,200 deer collected by hunters resulted in three additional positive deer for CWD. We have real concerns about how House File 434 would allow importation of animals without adhering to our best management practices related to CWD. Unfortunately, our current testing methods are a lagging indicator related to the disease. We have invested as a state in the University of Minnesota's Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach, or MinPro, on a live test. We would support importing animals once we do have a live test that can confirm conclusively that those animals, by a validated test, do not have the disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Do members have any questions for Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. This bill is being laid over, is that correct?
That's correct.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Van.
I think that's really important. You know, I know this was going to go to the floor, and with the testimony from the DNR, really, you know, this and other bills have come forward undoing some of the work we did, comprehensive work we did on CWD in the past few years. And when we start dealing with these one-offs, we're really juggling biological grenades until one of the pins falls out. And this is really an example of that. I think Representative Anderson, it would be good when hopefully we are co-equal in the future to bring in the University of Minnesota Prion Research Center to give an update on the live test for the committee. I think that would be helpful. But until then, we should continue the strongest protections we have. And I'm glad you're laying this over.
Any further questions, Representative Hansen? Anybody, other members have any questions? All right then, Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding comments on your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think the thing that's missing here is having a validated live animal test. Currently, the only way to test for it is brain tissue of a dead animal. So that's what we really need to have, and it's being worked on, I know, but not quite ready yet. And I guess what I would ask for would be that the DNR, Commissioner of the DNR, may issue at some point a permit allowing this importation of wild cervidae reindeer in this case, following a joint risk-based assessment conducted by the Commissioner and the institution. So with that, Madam Chair, I would move to have House File 434 laid over.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. With that, House File 434 is laid over. Without objection, Chair Anderson will stay at the table and take up House File 1702. Chair Anderson, please move your bill.
Again, Madam Chair, thank you. This is an important bill, I think. This committee has had a long tradition of funding farm safety initiatives, as well as seeing the importance of mental health and what the state does in terms of helping farmers and really everybody in the very important topic of mental health. And what this bill simply does, Madam Chair, is allocate $100,000 in fiscal year 26 and $100,000 in 27 to the Department of Ag and the Commissioner for outreach and support to farmers, ranchers, and others in the ag community. And I would also hope to see some of that could be used in the area of farm safety. We've talked about grain bin safety, where farmers can get sucked into a moving grain bin of grain, and that can be deadly. So with that, Madam Chair, I would ask for support for House File 1702, which allocates some money. And we also have an amendment, Madam Chair.
Chair Anderson, we'd like to bring the testifier first. Commissioner Tom Peterson would like to speak to the bill. Welcome, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Tom Peterson, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Now, I just wanted to just be on the record of saying that appreciate Representative or Chairman Anderson's long history in supporting this legislation. We've, really gone back many times to it really started quite a few years ago. The Star Tribune did a story about tractor rollovers and that we had so many deaths in tractor rollovers, and then we created our first piece on that. And then in 2019, we had 11 Minnesotans died in bins and in silos, really tragic year. And so along the way that this dollar appropriation has been in there and does a lot of good work. And so not just on the ROPS, which is a tractor rollover, the grain bin safety that you know, we continue to work on, but also our mental health crisis lines and other outreach that we do. And just a reminder that we have all that information on our website if you ever get to share it on your newsletters or anything like that, because you can call, text, or email any of that. So it has been crucial funding. But I also wanted to say it's currently was not in the base for this last year, and it is not currently in the governor's budget, but it's something, and it over the years that's happened. But, you know, we're committed to continuing to work on this as we go forward and continuing work with the governor and MMB and then the committees. But just wanted to be on the record saying that we support the general effort of this because it is important.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do members have any questions for Commissioner Peterson? No, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thank you. Our next testifier is Gail Donkers, a farmer from Minnesota Farmers Union, testifying remotely. Please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Gail Donkers, and I'm a farmer in southeastern Minnesota in Faribault. Thank you, Chair Harder, and the members of the committee. My family raises soybeans, corn, alfalfa. We finish hogs, bottle calves, and market weight cattle, and raise baby doll and Dorset sheep that we sell for breeding stock across the United States. On behalf of myself and Minnesota Farmers Union, I'm glad to share our strongest support for continuing our state's investment in farm and rural mental health and safety. This investment, which I know has been leveraged significantly from federal funds, has allowed MDA to be a national leader in helping farm families and others manage stress, prioritize their mental health, and stay safe on the farm. In part, this appropriation helps MDA manage the Farm and Rural Helpline, which connects farmers and others to mental health support. Farming can be a stressful job. You're often working alone, you're dealing with huge amounts of money and tight margins, and at the end of the day, there's a lot that you just don't control. The weather, input costs, or trade wars, to name a few. When the stress reaches a certain point, it's really important that there's a resource there and that it's easy to access. I can say that from personal experience because I've accessed these resources personally. In November of 2019, I had the opportunity to attend the Safe Talk 4-hour face-to-face workshop that was sponsored by MDA. The Safe Talk workshop teaches how to prevent suicide by recognizing signs, engaging someone, and connecting them to an intervention resource for further support. The training was completely and fulfilling, and there was a waiting list for the attendees. And I am grateful for this training and have used it multiple times. I have a farmer mental health resource page on my phone that I keep readily at access and have shared with many others over that time that I received information from at that health workshop. I have also reached out directly to Monica McConkie to learn how to help a family member that was dealing with depression. Monica and I had a deep discussion, and she helped me to organize a step-by-step intervention and get my family member the help that they so desperately needed. Just this past Sunday, I had a very deep discussion with a farmer that is a brand new dad. He has shared that his wife had gone through postpartum depression and deep anxiety, and it put a real strain on their family and their farm. I felt well equipped from my training to help and listen and assist this farmer. Additionally, Minnesota Farmers Union is working with several of our counties to host COMET trainings across the state. COMET stands for Changing Our Mental and Emotional Trajectory and is a 2-hour interactive training that teaches participants how to reach out in a respectful and supportive way to friends, coworkers, customers, or acquaintances that seem to be struggling with mental health, and they're somewhere in between the wellness and mental health crisis area. And these are sponsored by MDA and Minnesota Health. There was a time when I wouldn't have wanted to talk about mental health issues due to the stigma that surrounded mental health. But in part through the trainings and outreach from MDA, I've come to know that we're all better off when we can share these things. And I'll say MDA's work in the mental health area has done a lot to destigmatize talking about mental health. Finally, I'd like to add this appropriation also supports related work on farm safety. farming can be a dangerous occupation. Farming is listed as the third most dangerous occupation in the United States, and there's a lot we can do to educate farmers about how to keep themselves, their families, and their employees safe on the job. I'm proud to represent Minnesota Farmers Union on the Farm Safety Working Group, which does really important work to connect groups and state agencies around this topic. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill forward, and to the committee for your consideration and for continuing to fund this going forward.
Thank you, Gail. Do members have any questions for our testifier? All right. Our third testifier is Hunter Peterson, Minnesota Farm Bureau. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Hunter Peterson, Minnesota Farm Bureau. On behalf of our 31,000 family farm and ranch members, thank you for the opportunity to share our support of House File 1702. Just want to iterate that Farm Bureau strongly supports funding from to MDA for farmer mental health outreach and farm safety grants. This week is American Farm Bureau's Agricultural Safety Awareness Program Week, so we appreciate the timeliness of this hearing. The challenges that farmers face today, as Ms. Donkers said, create immense financial and emotional stress for farmers. This stress, compounded by the often isolating nature of farm work, has led to alarming rates of mental health struggles within agricultural communities. Programs like the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline and mental health counseling services have proven to be invaluable lifelines for those in crisis. Additionally, farm safety grants play a critical role in preventing accidents and injuries on the farm. Agriculture remains one of the most dangerous industries, with risks of equipment and machinery accidents, grain bin accidents, and livestock-related injuries. Farm Bureau as an organization also strives to elevate safety and health in agricultural and rural communities to reduce the number of farm work-related injuries and deaths by promoting safe practices and increasing public awareness. County Farm Bureaus participate in and host activities like farm and home safety forums for youth and adults, and farmer and community wellness events on topics like mental health and substance abuse. At our Leadership Education Advocacy and Promotion Conference this past January, we hosted an education workshop on managing farm stress and recognizing the signs of mental health struggles. Investing in farm safety measures such as cost share programs for safety equipment, worker education, emergency preparedness will prevent accidents from occurring and save lives. Likewise, continued mental health outreach funding will ensure that farmers can receive the help they need before it's too late. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to express our support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Do members have any questions for our testifier? I am seeing none. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 1702? Not seeing any. Okay. Representative Hansen has the A1 amendment. Representative Hansen, would you like to offer your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1 amendment. I think it just clarifies that these programs also apply to farm workers and employees. And I would ask if Representative Anderson could accept this.
Chair Anderson?
Madam Chair, yes, I would accept Representative Hansen's amendment as a friendly amendment and would encourage member support.
You can ask for discussion. Is there any discussion on the amendment for members? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. All right, is there any further discussion on House File 1702 as amended? I'm seeing none. Chair Anderson, do you have any closing comments on House File 1702 as amended?
No, Madam Chair, a lot has been spoken and very truthful about the issues of farm safety and such and mental health, and I would just ask for member support.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. House File 1702, as amended, is laid over. The next item of business is House File 1503. Representative Burko, please make your way to the testifying table and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Go ahead,
Chair.
Representative.
I would like to move House File 1503 to be laid over.
Representative Burkle, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to, if possible, could we move the A1 amendment right away, get the bill in shape?
Oh, yeah. We'll move the A1 amendment. Is that your
yeah,
wish?
Yeah, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Any member comments on the A1 author's amendment?
Very simple amendment, line 12. Just need to clean up some language that a lobbyist not to be named missed when the bill was drafted. And line on page 2, delete the enactment date. So that's the amendment.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye. The A1 is approved.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill itself, as you all know, state of Minnesota and the country has struggled with high path avian influenza, and this bill just establishes a program to award grants to poultry producers to install prevention measures on the farm. And with that, just to move things along quickly, I have a testifier. I'd like to just go right to the testifier and we can move it along.
Welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Ashley Coles, and I serve Minnesota's turkey industry as the executive director for the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. As you guys all know, last week was Poultry Day at the Capitol. Minnesota is the number one turkey-producing state in the nation, raising nearly 40 million turkeys annually and contributing significantly to our state's economy and rural communities. I'm here today in strong support of House File 1503, which establishes a grant program to assist producers with cost of wild bird deterrence on farms. Turkey growers in Minnesota have set the gold standard for biosecurity and prevention measures on turkey farms, and this can be displayed when you look at the number of farms impacted by high-path avian influenza, turkey farms impacted by high-path avian influenza in Minnesota versus the national numbers. So if you go back to 2022, there was roughly 57 million birds nationally impacted. Minnesota had about 4 million turkeys. In 2023, 21 million birds nationally, 1.1 million turkeys in Minnesota. And in 2024, back up to 50 million birds annually, and Minnesota reduced even further to just right around 1 million. So Minnesota turkey growers are doing a lot, but biosecurity is not enough to prevent high-path avian influenza infections. Additional layers of protection are also necessary to reduce the risk of exposure to commercial turkeys. And so bird deterrents, like turkey lasers, I think we testified on this bill last year. There was a lot of talk about turkey lasers. I think, Mark, are they supposed to have pictures? Do you have pictures for them? There's an example of what a turkey laser looks like. So there's a lot of confusion, and we still get a lot of questions about what these turkey lasers actually look like and how they work. So the picture that you have in front of you is a turkey laser installed on a commercial turkey farm. And so you can only see one laser, but a barn, a typical commercial turkey barn will have two of them, one on each end. As you can see, there's a grain bin right next to the barn, which does block the laser from hitting the ground in some places. So that's why you need two in order to be able to surround the barn completely. And so how these lasers work is they move continually, and they move very slowly. And if I had a video, I would show you, but they move very slowly, and this isn't an exaggeration on how fast they move. And the green light, there's a magic behind the green light, they say, that birds are scared of the green light specifically, which is why the light is green. And the laser moves in a randomized pattern to prevent birds from landing on or flying near, and in a lot of cases, from what we see flying over turkey barns specifically. This is also not a novel technology. This is the same technology that airports use to keep birds off of runways. Vineyards and orchards also use them to keep birds off of their trees and their berry bushes. Since 2023, Minnesota turkey growers have installed over 100 lasers on their farms. So we're contributing that to some of the reduction of impact of high path on turkey farms in the state. While some of those predate last year's grant, there were a number of them who took advantage, a number of growers who took advantage of the HPI prevention grants and grants like that in the past year. I think that's all that I have. I just want to say thank you again for hearing this bill today. Thank you, Representative Burkle, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Coles, I would ask the first question. You said this has been installed on about 100 farms or barns. So has the success rate been good?
Yeah, so it's 100 lasers, so it's not necessarily 100 barns, okay. Right? So there's okay. For most barns, it requires 2 lasers in order to be successful.
Okay.
And so from the folks who have installed, and I wish we could have gotten a gentleman here from the southeast corner who's seen a lot of success. But, you know, they, from the folks who install these lasers, they're not breaking with high path avian influenza, and they're actually seeing a change in bird patterns. And there's one guy, I think, who last week was here, and we're talking about the lasers he installed on his barn, that they want their neighbors to get them too because the birds are landing on their turkey barn now instead of his after he installed his lasers. And so, you know, just for justification for this grant, there are a lot of folks who would like to install these lasers because they're seeing success and hearing success from their neighbors, but they are cost prohibitive, which is justification for the grant. One laser costs roughly $17,000 to $20,000 per laser because we are competing with airports and the like, and if they require two per barn, it's a significant significant capital purchase for these folks. And so I guess that's just for the justification for a grant like this to help folks just layer on, again, another layer of protection in addition to robust biosecurity.
I have another question from Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question to perhaps Representative Burkle of how much of the funding you think you're thinking about. I know that we designated funding for turkey lasers last biennium in the last cycle, and I know that there's probably lots of federal funding coming. So I'm curious to see how much more funding do you think this program will be needed?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang, for that number. Bruce, could you come up? I believe last year's number is in the 300,000 range, but I want to check with Bruce for sure.
Welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. And we put in blank funding here pending the forecast tomorrow and how your committee budget comes together. Part of the reason this was blank is the department rolled this into a livestock disease prevention program last year, and it was part of a package. And so when we rejacketed the bill, it was to introduce the committee again this year, and no funding really set for it until we see what the targets are. Okay. That was our thought process anyway.
Any follow-ups, Representative Vang?
Yeah, I just wanted you guys to hone in on how much funding do you guys think you'll need to, I guess, address the need, because considering there's going to be lots of federal funds, there's already funding currently already, so how much more money do you guys think you'll need?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Representative Vang, I would say as much as we could possibly get to mitigate the problem in front of us. I think we've all seen in the last year the impact of avian influenza on the industry, especially in the layer industry, and I'd like to see this program expanded as much as possible in Minnesota just to mitigate the issue in the state.
Ms. Coles, go ahead.
Yeah. So just as a follow-up to the specificity to the federal funding that was currently rolled out by Secretary Rollins in the past 10 days or so, there is some specificity to that money for egg layers, right? So there's currently not a carve-out in that for turkey currently. We're working on getting some clarification as to see if the turkey industry does qualify for some of those dollars. But as of right now, they are solely focused on the egg layers.
Yeah. I was going to mention that also. That's my take of that, too, so far. It's to bring down the price of eggs. Anything else, Representative Vang?
No, that'll be all. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay, thank you. Representative Burkle, further comments? We have a couple of amendments to get to. How do you want to proceed with those?
Let's proceed with the amendments, Mr. Chair.
We have the A2. I believe that's Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle. When we had the previous testimony last week with the Board of Animal Health, there was a discussion about the movement of raw pet food from poultry or livestock that were potentially have been culled. So this would ban that sale and distribution, an explicit ban. The Bill 1503 is described as an avian influenza prevention program. So this would, I believe, fall under that title and in the clauses. So it helps prevent the spread that has been occurring from raw pet food.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Representative Anson would clarify his understanding of cult, because I'm curious as to how he's come up with this amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle, those would be ones with depopulation programs. I realize that most of those are composted, but obviously something got through the system. So when there's a depopulation and there's culling, I am not talking about normal culling of cows, but if there is a positive IPATH avian influenza that is occurring and you are depopulating turkeys, chickens, or other livestock, then that pet food, that raw meat would not be made into pet food to be distributed.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. And I guess I fail to understand the logic of the amendment other than, I mean, from my own experience, just knowing what culled birds, what happens when you compost culled birds, they, you know, on a quarantine farm, there's no avenue for that product to be in pet food. So that confuses me. But beyond that, it's really technically this would be an FDA issue, a food safety issue at FDA, not initially part of MDA, unless MDA would like to comment on that. But in my mind, this is a federal FDA issue.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle, actually, the Department of Ag does deal with pet food regulation, and I believe this is a simple requirement. Obviously, something got through. We had that testimony in this committee where the likelihood of raw pet food, and that the Board of Animal Health testified that they did not have that explicit authority for banning it. So I would move the A2 and ask for a roll call.
An A2 has been, A2 roll call vote has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lawrence.
If I may, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen has brought into the comment from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture on their role in this, and I guess I was curious if they would mind commenting before we vote on this. That'd be.
If they are still here.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Yes. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, Chair and Committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is Michelle Medina, and I serve as the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So when animals are, when you detect IPATH on a farm, those animals are culled per the USDA, so they become USDA property. They're not allowed to enter the food stream. We do follow FDA guidance for our commercial feed and food division program that we have, but also IPATH is considered an adulteration. Adulterated food is not allowed into the food supply. That is both human and pet food. So any IPATH positive animals are not allowed already per state and federal regulation to enter the food supply.
Okay. Thank you very much. Roll call has been asked. The clerk will take a roll. The chair votes no.
Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Agbaje?
Yes.
Representative Burkle?
No.
Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Gander?
No.
Representative Jacob?
No.
Representative Lawrence?
Lawrence votes no.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Vang?
Yes.
By a vote of 7-6, the amendment does not pass. We now have the A3. Again, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment, again, we're under the heading of Avian Influenza Prevention Program. The bill, 1503, as it stands, assumes that the only transmission would be from wild birds to domestic poultry. And so it provides for devices on that assumption. What the A3 amendment does is inserts money with the University of Minnesota to monitor manure, compost, and air quality. There has been recent publications that one of the sources of transmission may be manure. And so it gets in the air, moves, and a laser isn't going to stop that. The commissioner would coordinate with the Board of Regents to monitor wastewater treatment systems for the presence of avian influenza. The commissioner must provide personal protective equipment for agricultural workers, farm workers, poultry and livestock processors, processing employees and provide biomonitoring for the presence of avian influenza in those agricultural workers, farm workers, or poultry and livestock processing employees that volunteer. So a voluntary biomonitoring program to see if the virus or if the disease is being brought into human population. And then it says, if there are federal dollars that come to the State Department of Agriculture for biosecurity, that they be distributed through a randomized process rather than a first-come, first-serve. We have seen, and I think former Chair Vang would note, that on prior grants, when there's first-come, first-serve, those that are ready, maybe the larger ones that have the ability or staff to apply for those grants. So the randomized money, if that is applicable for the state. Then when we get to line page two, these appropriations with the dollar figures are based on appropriations that were provided previously to the University of Minnesota for COVID monitoring. That initial creative research was nation-leading. You know, many of us have probably seen the COVID monitoring in wastewater. That actually started with a research at the University of Minnesota that was an emergency grant from the Legislative and Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources on March 17th, 2020, almost 5 years ago. So using those same appropriations, we'd look at wastewater, drinking water treatment, and then also public water and private wells to see if there is contamination of avian influenza in the water. So I'd ask for your support and a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I would say this is a pretty sizable amendment. It gets into a lot of cost and a lot of mandates. Had you discussed this with Representative Burkle prior to this?
Mr. Chair, I did not discuss this with Representative Burkle. We have had a very limited time in the minority here. I anticipate that in the near future, we may be at an equal number. My purpose in this is getting these topics out here. It's a lot faster to draft an amendment than it is to get a bill drafted in this current environment. And so I think these are important factors to have that hearing and get it out here. My understanding is the bill is being laid over. I think these are important topics that we should consider, hopefully equally in the near future.
Representative Burkle, it's your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. It is a pretty extensive amendment. It looks more like the workings of maybe a bill you should draft at some point down the road. I would request everyone vote no, simply because it is that extensive, and what we're really trying to do here is alleviate some of the stress for the farm and the folks on a farm that are dealing with the financial and emotional stress of dealing with high path avian influenza and trying to prevent that. I do have a question about... I mean, this, as far as the manure composting air quality situation, it seems like something that belongs at MPCA. And the Department of Health is already monitoring wastewater. I guess this really should be a bill, Representative Hansen, at some point. Providing PPE, I can tell you from firsthand experience back in 2015 when I broke with HIPATH AI that PPE was provided, biomonitoring was provided. I was called daily, as was my son, to check into our health situation, see if we had any signs, symptoms of any kind of influenza, and even got a prescription to Tamiflu. So kind of redundant there. I guess as extensive as the amendment is, and maybe Department of Ag would like to speak to it at some level, but I'd ask members to vote no.
Representative Commissioner Peterson is getting up and coming on over. Welcome back, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Tom Peterson, Commissioner. Yeah, just a few comments. I think Representative Burkle and sorry, Representative Hansen, too, haven't had a chance to visit with you about this. And it is really, really important issue. You know, and just a few thoughts. I think that you know, on the wastewater and the we'd probably prefer working with the MPCA on that rather than the Board of Regents just because of what they're or the manure with that, and then the Department of Health on wastewater. I did want to say, though, on line C, want to make it very clear, the Department of Health is here in the audience, too, that they do make PPE available for farmers. So, goggles are the really important thing, because one of the things we've seen in the human health cases is conjunctivitis, masks, gloves, all of that. Your farmers in your district, if they want to, we have the link right on our website where farmers can go and apply. And Department of Health's been a great partner in this. And so also in the testing that goes through, and we have a positive farm, we did have not just we've been doing this on poultry all along, or the Department of Health has, but also on the dairy farms this summer, that we offer testing, we get a lot picked up. But we also want, legislators to know that farmers in your district can get the free PPE. And Minnesota, I think, has had the best uptake of any state in the nation on their supplies to help the workers, too, and everything. And so the other thing I would just mention is the federal funds, we're going to kind of see, as Ms. Cole said, this was just rolled out last week. It is my concern, too, is we do have layers in our state, but not like some other states. Our big industry is obviously the turkey industry, and this is highly focused on eggs and egg prices. So as commissioner, I've been advocating for this also to go into turkeys as well. So just a few comments, and appreciate, glad to keep working on this, because it is an important issue.
Thanks, Commissioner Peterson. Final thoughts, Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just would ask members to vote no on the amendment, and you can take the roll.
Representative Hansen, your final thoughts.
Mr. Chair, my intent here was to get these topics out here. Do I have your commitment that you will continue to work with our side on these topics?
Yes. Yes, you do. Yep.
And we will withdraw the amendment.
Okay. The A3 amendment has been withdrawn. And now to the bill, House File 1503. Any final comments from members? Seeing none, Representative Burkle, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just appreciate the hearing today. Appreciate Representative Hansen's comments and his amendment, understanding what he's trying to do there, but really feel that this bill addresses a situation really on the ground with farmers that are really dealing with a financial stress and an emotional stress that, and we've all seen what avian influenza can do to our poultry industry. So with that, I'd appreciate a yes vote on the bill. Or no, we're laying this over. Sorry.
Actually, yes, the bill will be laid over. So House File 1503 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Burkle. Thank you to committee members. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.